Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to Hedgeye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back to another Real Conversation with one of my favorites. I'm not supposed to have favorites, Jim, but I guess that's what my wife says to me with our four kids. And I don't, for the record on that, but you are one of my favorite people to have on Hedgeye TV to have a real conversation. You've been kind enough to do it going like all the way back when Hedgeye is still not like a big thing, but you know, when we were absolutely nothing. So thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Keith. This is one of my favorite shows as well. So if we're playing favorites, I'll just return the compliment.
A little bromance here. I like that. So I have, Jim's one of my favorite authors, strategists, historians. Like when I think of like my process, like history, math, behavioral, Jim covers all the bases. That's why we have, I guess, biases towards each other. We both read a lot of books. So when I was, in my pile, like I have a pile, like people are sending me books now. It's like the pizza thing with Portnoy to a degree. So I have I have to pick what books I'm going to read. So in order, I actually had I had your book, which is, I think we have a shot of it, but here it is anyway. There it is, Jim's new book, Great Depression and How to Think About like this post, or pandemic, he'll define it in terms of the world that we're in. And I actually had one of my other great, leaders in my life, he sent me another book called How to Drink. That was right under that, and this one's How to Be a Bad Emperor. So how to, and it's, there's so many different things, like, about this. Incidentally, this guy that sent me the other two books is he's retired from Wall Street. He's also a rabbi. But you started your book, as you often do, and I'm a, please don't cancel, I'm a Irish Catholic, but you started with a quote from the Revelations, and that's what, guys, if you can pop that up, that's what I wanted to start with, Jim. Like you obviously have written a bunch of books now. You have the compilation of books. But this this quote in particular, if we can't pop it up there, I'll just read it myself. I've read it multiple times, but this is Revelations 15:1. And I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them is filled up with the wrath of God. Now, why did you start with that?
Well, first of all, Revelations is obviously, it's actually a particular genre of literature called apocalyptic literature, but apocalypse doesn't mean like everything, death and destruction. It actually is a kind of prophecy, and the book of Daniel is, the Old Testament is considered apocalyptic, as is the book of Revelation. So since my books are always forward-leaning, and just to, I get into plugging books, but I had a book in 2019, called Aftermath.
Right.
And if you turn to page 290 and just read a couple pages, it talks about pandemic and says there's 100% chance it will happen in the next 3 years. And then a few paragraphs later it says there'll be armed gangs and armed militias in the streets. So kind of nothing happened in 2020 that we didn't tell you about in 2019. Same thing with this book. It takes you, it covers the landscape today, of course, but takes you into the rest of 2021, 2022. So I was looking at the book of Revelation because of that prophetic apocalyptic mode. But of course, there's a particular passage that mentions plague. Also makes the point that there's nothing new about plagues and pandemics. The Peloponnesian War, the outcome of the Peloponnesian War pivoted on pandemic in Athens. There was more to it than that, but that was a big feature. So hopefully we were kind of connecting the dots there.
Yeah, and you weren't, like as most people, you'll get labeled, I get labeled, we all get labeled. We're all, if you're triggering somebody, we're going to be labeled. But right. The book, like, even if someone wasn't, not as many people read in this day and age, a lot of our subscribers do, but even if you weren't to actually read the book and you were to say, wow, look at the cover, this is really scary, right in the introduction for people that haven't, even read the first page, like a virus can cause disease and pandemic, yet it cannot directly cause an economic collapse. That's up to us. That's up to us part is where I wanted to start, which is where you started the book. So go for it.
Right. So obviously we have a pandemic and it's a bad one. By the way, there's a study from the it's an economic paper, but the lead author was with the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, but a couple of academic colleagues, collaborators, and I think they were from the University of California. But they did a time series, a 650-year time series. That's my kind of time series. I always criticize people saying, here's my time series. Yeah, it's 6 months or 1 year. I mean, that's garbage. So they go back 650 years to the Black Death. And they looked at every pandemic since 1350 in which 100,000 or more people died. And they found 15 of them. By the way, this COVID pandemic is going to end up number three on the list. Not quite there yet, but the number three on the list right now is 2 million fatalities. COVID's 1.9 million, rising fast. So COVID's going to be number three after the Black Death and the Spanish flu, which were much greater. But that kind of puts it in perspective. But they were economists, not virologists or epidemiologists, but that was their time series in their database. And what they discovered is that back to normal. We'll never get back to normal. There's no more normal. We will survive. We'll get through it, but things will be different going forward. But you know, forget any kind of normal. But what they discovered is that, you know, in terms of interest rates and growth and capacity and other factors, it takes 30 to 40 years to get back to some kind of normal. So when Jay Powell says, you know, well, interest rates are not going up until 2023, I was like, well, thank you, Jay. Why don't you try 2043? Because that's really a much more, that's the right way to think about it. So we talk about that in the book, but part of it is, you know, so pandemics are not new. They've happened before. This will be one of the worst actually in history. But that by itself doesn't necessarily sink the economy. It's the public policy response, individual choices, and government officials responding to the pandemic that causes the economic damage. And there's a lot to that, but the biggest single factor, and I have a whole chapter on this, chapter two, is the lockdown. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just start with the fact, lockdowns don't work. They do not stop the spread of the virus, but they do destroy economies. So the choice of a lockdown, which was the main public policy choice, in hindsight, well, actually right now, we don't have to wait for hindsight, it will be one of the greatest public policy blunders in history. And I lay part of the blame, there's not blame to go around, but you know, President Trump, so okay, he had to respond to this, but you know, Dr. Fauci, who I consider to be, you know, an over the hill bureaucrat, and he's held out, you know, the great immunologist, well, okay, he is an immunologist technically, but he's not, there's nothing great about him. There are people at Stanford and Harvard and Rockefeller Institute and Johns Hopkins and elsewhere with far more expertise who are saying that lockdowns don't work. That was, Trump kind of handed it over to them. And Fauci goes, oh, we don't do economic policy. We're just doctors. Nonsense. They dictated the lockdown. And here's the point. I reached that conclusion last spring, kind of May, April timeframe, based on the evidence we had. But since then, there's been a flood of data. You know, we have a lot more data, a lot more studies, and they show conclusively the lockdowns don't work. Let me be specific. So we never had a national lockdown. We had 50 states and governors and mayors making up rules, imposing their own lockdowns or not. We had extreme lockdowns in places like New York and California. And then in South Dakota, you had no lockdown. The governor of South Dakota made it voluntary. They had recommendations, but they didn't lock it down. And everything in between. Same thing around the world. Korea had an extreme lockdown. Sweden was moderate, not nearly as severe as Korea, but they took some measures. Others, like Brazil, did far less. The data is in. And what it shows is that the caseload and the fatalities were unaffected by your type of lockdown, whether it was extreme, moderate, or not at all. Your experience with caseload and fatalities relative to population were the same, which, you know, statistically, that means that lockdowns have no effect on caseload and fatality. There's no correlation, which means they don't work. They do destroy economies. They're very good at destroying economies. So we'll look back and say, and by the way, it doesn't mean don't do anything. Yeah, washing your hands makes sense. Social distancing makes sense. Masks, that's a little more, the evidence is more iffy, but you know, wear a mask. I wear a mask when I go out shopping. I'm not going to fight with the greeter at Walmart. I put my mask on. But that's a very low cost thing. This is a 90-10 problem. You could have got 90% of the benefit of the lockdown at 10% of the cost. Yeah. But that's, you know, that's typical. And by the way, lockdowns have killed more people than they've saved. Suicide rates have tripled. Murder rates have doubled. Drug abuse up. Alcohol abuse up. Domestic abuse up. The anger, the frustration, the clinical depression are all rising steeply. And further on in the book, in chapter five, I have a whole chapter on mental health aspects of this, which is underappreciated, not well understood. But when you look at the riots all summer and the recent riot on Capitol Hill, I mean, you got to take the politics out of it. And if you're a politician, you probably can't. But I say in the book, the virus is not a Democrat or a Republican. The virus just wants to kill you. The virus just wants to kill you. That's what you have to understand. Get the politics out of it. So whether it's left-wing violence or right-wing violence, of course, all the violence should be condemned. But the point I'm making is don't underestimate the extent to which COVID and the pandemic and the lockdowns and the quarantines have contributed to that by isolating people, destroying social interaction, increasing depression and anger. And are we surprised to see it playing out the way it is on the streets? So the lockdown will, as I say, one of the greatest blunders in history, doesn't stop the spread of the disease. I reached that conclusion 7 months ago, but the evidence is in, it's very clear. That's what this great Barrington Declaration is all about. But it does destroy the economy, and that's what we've done.
When we get, and we'll get into this, but you know, you're talking, like when you go, like you always do, 20, 30, 40 years, you know, the only other person that I think that does that adequately and succinctly with historical fact as opposed to opinion is Neil Howe, for example, and uses demography as his anchor. But like you said, a time series at 650 years old is quite valuable. So that, thank you for starting with that. Because the struggle that I think a lot of people have, and I hope not to have it, I mean, there's a cyclical trade that we've been riding. But that trade, to be clear, ends, you know, going into the spring and the summertime, and then we get back into the real deal, which is what is the, you know, as you call, you know, the aftermath, or however you want to describe, you know, what is the labor market? What does it look like? What does it mean to have closed all of these small businesses that are never coming back? One slide that, you know, a simple slide that we always showed, Jim, is, which you're readily aware of, is slide 76 on just non-farm employment. You know, like, we can have, you know, cyclical market rallies, we can have cyclical inflations, but what is going to be secular here? And that's really the, you know, I think it's a hard question to answer, but I think what you said is that it just takes a long, long time to dig out of these, you know, not just, you know, moral hazard holes, but these holes. You know, it takes time and space. Is that a fair way to, you know, start to think about this in, you know, amidst the cyclicality of something that's shorter term or intermediate term for that matter?
That's absolutely the right way to think about it. And I say in the book, you know, this is not like the 2008 global financial crisis, which, by the way, was a financial crisis. What we're in today is an economic crisis, and there's a difference between the two. It's not the 2000 dot-com crash, which, you know, stock market went down, but there wasn't a lot of leverage behind it, so that didn't rip off. You have to go back to the Great Depression for the right frame of reference. And, you know, we all know the stock market crashed in October 1929. It didn't hit bottom until June 1932. It was down 89.2%. That's what a real stock market crash looks like without the Fed there to, you know, kind of prop things up. But then ask the question from the bottom in 1932, down 89.2%. When did it regain the old high? When did it get back to the 1929 high? The answer is 1954. It took 25 years to get back to that level. Now, it doesn't mean you couldn't make money. If you bought the low in 1932, you could ride it back, although we had another recession in 1937, 1938. But it took 25 years to regain the high. That's the right frame of reference. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, which is a very prosperous time in U.S. history. I did not live through the Great Depression, but my parents did. And my grandparents did. So I was raised with a kind of depression mentality, even though we weren't in a depression. We, you know, we used to save the rubber bands off the newspaper because, you know, why would you throw them away? And we, as 9-year-olds, we went out with our wagons and we went door to door and we collected tin cans and newspapers. Mm-hmm. It wasn't for like environmental reasons. We were recycling things that could be turned into airplanes and battleships. I mean, that didn't change until the late 60s. It was the late 60s when the baby boom came of age and it was, you know, rock and roll party on credit cards and, you know, mortgages and leverage and all the rest. That's when we left it behind. But that was 30 years from the 1930s to the 1960s. The effects of this are intergenerational. So, you know, I've got, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-old grandchildren and, you know, their mother says, okay, honey, you know, put on your hat, put on your coat and put on your mask. And they do, you know, kids are adaptable. They roll with it, but putting on a mask every day, that's going to stay with you the rest of your life. So the idea that, you know, the V-shaped recovery, I always says, was nonsense. The idea of the V-shape is goes down steeply, up steeply, and we're back where we were. That didn't happen. It went down steeply. It started up steeply, which is to be expected, but then it truncated, flattened out. And that's where we are now. In fact, I would say we're actually in a recession now. This will be the first back-to-back recession since 1980, 1981. We can spend more time on that if you like, but we didn't come all the way back. So it's like falling into a 50-foot hole. climbing out 20 feet. Okay, nice job, nice climbing, but you're still in the hole. And that's where we are. And so again, the effects of this will play out until the 2040s in terms of adaptive behavior. You know, let's say all the restaurants reopen. They're not, by the way. Very large percentage.
And when they do, they're not going to open up the same way.
That's correct. But let's just say hypothetically they did. Doesn't mean people want to go out for dinner. I mean, people are scared. Mm-hmm. You know, airlines get back to normal. Doesn't mean you want to fly. I mean, again, these are intergenerational behavioral changes that are grossly underestimated by the happy talk crowd. You know, I would say the White House and Wall Street are both, you know. I had to roll my eyes when they started talking about pent-up demand. You know, as soon as I heard pent-up demand last spring, I thought, okay, this is green shoots again, you know, back to 2009 with Tim Geithner's green shoots. But there's no pent-up demand. You know, I make the point that during the first lockdown, the quarantine, you know, kind of March, April, May 2020, you know, I stayed home. I didn't go out to dinner. But my wife and I usually go out to dinner on a Friday night. Well, the restaurants didn't reopen until June, but we didn't go out March, April, May. So let's say in June, we go out to dinner. I didn't order nine dinners. Mm-hmm. I had skipped nine Fridays, but I didn't order nine dinners. I ordered one like I usually do. So in other words, that was a permanent loss. There's no pent-up demand for nine dinners just because you can go back out again. You know, maybe seem like a trivial example, but apply that through the economy, airline tickets, rental cars, hotels, resorts, dinners, bars, et cetera. There was no pent-up demand, and half these businesses are gone. They're just gone. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation we're in. I'd say it's a little worse than that, actually, because we're probably in a new recession right now.
Well, I mean, the happy talk comes in, and again, it's just behavioral. So you have recency bias, Wall Street, everybody, you know what that is, obviously. So getting back to the behavioral look of the three big things I care about. I mean, Wall Street, and for that matter, COVID, companies that were COVID recipients, they feel fantastic. They feel beyond green shoots. But what does that really mean? Like, you and I were having an offline discussion about, like, I just got back from the Bahamas, where there are a lot of rich people, right? And right. One guy, he owns, older guy, he just sold his chain of Southern restaurants, and it'd be inappropriate to say which one it is. And he's like, tell me about how bad it is for all those people he used to lead and employ, because it ain't coming back. He said, ain't come back. But let me tell you how much fucking money I'm making day trading this market.
Right.
He said at one point, I'm making more. It used to take legions of cost structure to make that kind of money. I worked my whole life. The guy's like in his 70s. And I'm just, this is like a joke. Like, but yeah. He's one guy with a massive house in the Bahamas and a nice big boat too. That's not the real world.
Yeah, well, the stock market and the real economy have never been more detached. Now, obviously, the stock market not only recovered its losses from the February to March 2020 collapse, but it's beyond that. We're at new all-time highs. Okay, but that's not the real economy. Just to be more specific, you know, we have the S&P 500, so-called. Well, it's really the S&P 7. We know who they are. It's you know, Facebook, Google, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Tesla, and Netflix. Those seven stocks are 40% of the S&P 500. It's a cap-weighted index, and the market caps of those companies are so big. They are 40% of the index. So they go up. They're the least affected by the pandemic because they're technological. They're not, bricks and mortar, et cetera. They're streaming, they're online shopping, you know, and so forth. So they're going up. So what happens? People are passive investors. They're buying index funds. So more money comes in. They go up some more. More money comes in. They go up some more. And look, I'm not saying short the S&P 500. That's like standing in front of a 18-wheeler going 70 miles an hour. You're going to get crushed. But it does have bubble dynamics and has nothing to do with the real economy. Let's flip over to the economy. What is that? Small and medium-sized enterprises, so all these Wall Street members, they look down their nose at, you know, your local restaurant, bar, nail salon, dry cleaner, boutique shop, et cetera. Sorry, that's small and medium-sized business are 50% of all jobs and 45% of GDP. You are crushing it with these lockdowns. You are killing that sector of the economy. You can't kill half the economy and not expect a recession, which is what we're doing right now. By the way, the pandemic data, which we have, I use the Johns Hopkins dashboard, which, like everyone else, since very reliable. The caseload compared, so go back to last March and April, that was, everyone remembers how horrible it was. The caseload is 10 times greater. not twice as bad, three times as bad. It's 10 times greater. The fatalities are more than double. So this is far worse than what we experienced last March and April. Governors and mayors are doing what they always do, which is locking it down. Doesn't work. We already talked about that, but fine. You lock it down. Who's getting locked down? Not Amazon, not Apple, not Costco. It's the bars and restaurants and nail salons and boutique shops, all the places I mentioned. But it's half the economy. And then these businesses, I mean, they don't have $5 million of working capital. They make money. They pay their bills. There's a little profit for the owner. Actually, we have data on this in terms of working capital for small and medium-sized enterprises, depending on whether the particular enterprise, it's somewhere between 30 and 90 days of working capital. That's what they have. Well, that was gone last summer. And so now it's not a question, oh, yeah, well, you'll come back. We'll change the rules. No, they're gone. They're bankrupt. The storefronts are vacant. They're up for lease. The equipment's on sale at fire sale prices, and the employees are home, and they're not even unemployed technically because they're not looking for jobs, because why would you if you're a bartender and all the bars are closed? So that's where you have to look at labor force participation rather than the unemployment. I'm not saying the government lies or makes it up. I mean, I'm sure their statistical methods are fine, but you have to understand what they are. Labor force participation is back where it was in the 70s. In other words, it's close to 60%. It never gets to 100. I mean, that's nonsense, because there's always good reasons for some people not to be in the labor force. You know, you're a homemaker or a student or, you know, retired early, whatever it might be. But 70 is high, 60 is low, and we're right around 60, right? 60%. So there are at least 10 million able-bodied people between the ages of 25 and 54 who don't have jobs but are not counted as unemployed. You put them in the unemployment numbers, you have depression levels of unemployment. So that's where we are. So stock market, you know, knock yourself out, as we used to say in high school. It was a popular song, knock yourself out. But it's not the real economy, and people have to understand that.
And I think as we go forward in time, you know, it's going to be harder for people to project me fully loaded. That's why I get a machine to do it. So it just tells me what the answer is, or the probability weighting of the answer. And you go from this world of I'm going to give you cash, because the counter to this is going to be, well, we're going to have MMT, and instead of control print on just markets, we're going to control print jobs, right? We have Janet Yellen, I think, guys, you can pop that, you know, nice picture. We put CeCe Rouse right beside Janet Yellen, as you might even giggle on this. But, you know, the reality is that those are two labor economists. One's from Harvard, and one on the right is from Harvard, and the other one's from Princeton. So what what we're going to do, and we have the guy in the middle, you know, the man in the tower in the middle, is going to be the one that, you know, hits the print button. So what happens when you start to get into this part of MMT, which they quite literally want to print jobs, and they will use words. You used it first, but she used it, was interesting. I found it was interesting, not only not ironic, and it's obviously she's put there for that, for Wall Street's reasons, but Janet Yellen's speech when she's like accepting this job is that it was about having the decency of a living wage, of having a job. She's telling a story about her father and how she always wanted to do this for the people, blah, 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 blah. I'm sure she did at this point. She better. But the most important thing, Jim, is that they're going to try to do it. They're going to actually try to do the thing that you've been saying since the beginning of time. This doesn't end here. This experiment is going to go right to where it goes.
Well, one of the first of all, you're exactly right, Keith. I mean, Janet Yellen is not just a liberal labor economist, but she's what's called a frequentist statistician, which means, you know, more data, more data, more data.
Yeah.
She doesn't understand what to do if there's not a ton of data. New problems are, she just stares at, you know, she can't deal with them because she's waiting for more data. That's what frequentist statistics is all about.
Or a linear econ. Did you get called a linear econ? Not Jim Rickards, no.
Yeah. And so Janet Yellen is staring. All she does all day is stare at the Phillips curve. And of course, the Phillips curve is a flat line. I was very good at geometry, but I never remember a curve that was a straight line. I thought curves were supposed to be curved. But so she's staring at a flat Phillips curve saying, here comes the inflation any day. She doesn't understand velocity, believe it or not. She actually doesn't understand monetary policy, even though she was the head of the Fed. But she's in Treasury for a reason. Because modern monetary theory, and by the way, I know Stephanie Kelton in person, very nice lady, but man, I mean, one of the hardest things I do, one of the most painful things I do is read books of people I really disagree with. You have to. I mean, you just have to, you know, widen the aperture and, you know, get out of your little bubble. And so cognitive diversity is my kind of diversity. So I've read Stephanie Kelton's book and her papers and I know her, but man, is this not only wrong, but scary. So one of the first things they do is they say, well, here's the Federal Reserve. It's, technically the regional reserve banks are privately owned. Everyone knows that. There's a board of governors in Washington that kind of runs the thing. Everybody knows that. And here's the Treasury. The Federal Reserve controls money supply and interest rates. The Treasury borrows and spends. But what they do is they merge the two. They say, take the balance sheet of the Treasury, which is the United States of America, take the balance sheet of the Fed, merge it. And they say that under no circumstances should borrowing capacity or interest rates be a constraint on spending. So the idea that you spend what you have, or if you don't have it, you have to borrow it or tax it. No, turn it around. Spend first and then figure out the rest of it, as opposed to thinking about, you know, borrowing and taxing as a constraint on spending. Just spend whatever it takes. Spend, you know, and every social need you can think of. And, you know, there's a long list: education, healthcare, childcare, et cetera. Just spend the money. And then if you have a deficit, too bad, just borrow the money. And if the bond market gets balky, the Fed buys the bonds, prints the money and puts it on the balance sheet and waits to maturity. What's the problem? And when I first encountered this, I had to stop right there and say, well, what is the problem? Actually, that is how it works. And you can do that. There is no legal constraint on the size of the Fed's balance sheet. And other than debt ceilings, which are always waived, always rolled over, there's no constraint on the Treasury's borrowing capacity. And if the market, the Chinese start dumping them, you call Jamie Dimon and say, Jamie, you know, buy some bonds. And if you don't, I'll put you out of business. So it doesn't appear to be a constraint. And so, but remember, she was chief economist on the Democratic side in the Senate Budget Committee when Bernie Sanders was the chairman,
right?
And the ranking member. She's the chief economic advisor to the Bernie Sanders campaign. And now that Biden is in, and Biden's not, you know, all there, but his staff are going to run the country, they put Janet Yellen. Well, if you believe the Treasury and the Fed should be merged, what better way to do that than to put the former head of the Fed as the Secretary of the Treasury?
100%.
So this is a huge giveaway that modern monetary theory is now the law of the land, if you want to think of it that way. So we saw we have $1 trillion per year baseline budget deficit. That was going into the pandemic before the pandemic even came along. So Trump got us back to $1 trillion, kind of where Obama left off in 2011, I think was the last $1 trillion deficit. So you have $1 trillion baseline deficit. The Congress put $3 trillion on top of that in March and April and May through the CARES Act and a couple other acts. So now you're up to $4 trillion for fiscal 2020. Now we're in fiscal 2021. We just had $1 trillion, about $900 billion, that got done in the last days of the Trump administration. But now Biden's going to come in and do, they think, $2 trillion on top of that. So, I mean, we're talking $6 trillion on top of a $2 trillion baseline budget deficit. $8 trillion of new debt in a $22 trillion economy. Our debt to GDP ratio is already, I haven't computed it lately, but it's at 130, he's gonna push 135% by the time they're done. Who's in that league? Well, I can tell you, it's Lebanon, Greece, and Italy. You know, that's your lunch table, your four-person lunch table. So that's the club the United States is now in. Modern monetary theory says, don't worry, because it's all in dollars and we print dollars, so we can never run out of money. Therefore, we can never go broke. I think that's literally true.
It is.
But it doesn't mean that people want the dollars.
And it doesn't mean that it works.
It doesn't mean that it works. It does. And here's the bottom line, just kind of putting an end to MMT. There's no legal boundary. That's true. There's no accounting boundary. That's true. But there's a confidence boundary. It's invisible, hard to know. You don't know you hit it until you hit it, and then things collapse. People forget 1977, the United States issued treasury bonds, treasury notes denominated in Swiss francs. They were called the Carter bonds, but they were denominated in Swiss francs. They said, people said, we'll take your credit, but we don't want the dollars. And so we did, and we issued Swiss franc denominated treasury notes. That's how bad it was in the late 70s. you know, it seems like the ice age to people today, but I remember it. And we could get back there very quickly. So, but yeah, I think it's important for investors and, you know, asset allocators to understand that MMT is not a novelty. It's not a fringe theory. It's going to be the primary economic policy of the Biden administration. Stephanie Kelton's working behind the scenes. Janet Yellen's the front person. Who better? Because she can merge the Treasury and the Fed. Powell's going to do what he's told. So will the big banks. And here it comes. So, you know, get ready.
Yeah, guys, so show slide 93, just so that you can, like, when Jim's, the words mean numbers. So we're showing here the deficit and obviously the Fed's balance sheet. So that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. That's why we got the, and for the larger part of the population, not a large part of this audience, Jim, that's too, that, even that chart with those words is a little too technical. So what our friend Stephanie did on slide 94, guys, is you tightened it up to that. Yeah, so that's a little. That's the first thing she did. That was her first tweet when it became apparent that you're going to have a light blue wave or whatever. And
right.
That's pretty easy. That's pretty easy to understand. I mean, that's so it's going to be what it's going to be. And I guess my next set of questions, I want to make sure we're going to leave 15, hopefully, minutes for questions. Let's just take. Because we can only talk about so much, but Biden. So, you know, however you want to, you know, think about, I know what the market thinks for the next 3, 4, 5, or maybe 6 months. I'm going to trade that. This discussion has nothing to do with that. This, for me, has selfishly has everything to do with what I do coming out of that. Okay,
right.
So that's in the 16 to 18 months after, you know, Sleepy Joe's, you know, still Sleepy Joe, and there you get, so spending, taxes, jobs, like maybe those three things. I mean, however you want to think about, what does the Biden administration mean to you?
Well, the Biden administration means the Obama administration untethered. And I don't know if Jack Dorsey's watching. Maybe I'll get canceled for saying that. But but look, I'm sorry. Biden's not all there. If he appears at all, it's a teleprompter. He can barely get through that. And they issue press releases. And, you know, we'll save it for another day, whether he's gone before the end of the year under the 25th Amendment. And Kamala Harris is acting president. Put that to one side. But I've gone very carefully through the backgrounds and the resumes of all the key cabinet appointments and sub-cabinet levels of all, you know, basically the Biden administration. They're all Obama veterans. Now, that's not shocking or surprising. You know, a new party comes in, they bring back every, you know, the B team gets to be the A team. But man, you know, the national security advisor was deputy national security advisor to Obama. The secretary of state was another deputy national security advisor under Obama. You know, the secretary of the treasury was Obama's pick for chairman of the Federal Reserve, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You just kind of go down that list. But so who's pulling the strings? Well, Obama. But now this is not the Obama of 2008. This is the Obama looking at Michelle's run in 2024. And with Valerie Jarrett living in the same house, and they built a SCIF. A SCIF, as you know, is a secure compartment and intelligence facility. Basically, you can't penetrate it. So they go into the SCIF, lock the door, and say what they want. And go
you mean
out
the
and,
one in the one in Martha's Vineyard?
The one in Kalorama, I think it's an upscale neighborhood of Washington,
D.C.
That one
in Martha's Vineyard, that's a nice house. That's really nice.
Yeah, but he's basically got a skiff, so he can't even, like, you know, listen in from outside, whatever. So this is the Obama administration, untethered by, you know, whatever moderate policy constraints he had in the past, looking forward to Michelle running in 2024, running the Biden administration with Biden no more than, you know, an empty shell, doing what he's told. It's interesting. They ran the AOC Bernie wing pretty much off the road. You don't see Bernie Sanders is not a cabinet appointment. Elizabeth Warren is not a cabinet appointment. AOC is not an undersecretary of anything. Those people got run off the road. Now they're still around. They'll be coming back. But the one voice, believe it or not, of the progressive wing that has fully penetrated the Biden administration is Stephanie Kelton, is modern monetary theory. Because mm-hmm. why wouldn't you like that? Because who doesn't want to spend more money? The only thing they've ever lacked, none of these programs are new. You know, Green New Deal, healthcare for all, child care for all, forgive student loans, you know, on and on. We can go down the list. they're not new. Guaranteed basic income, they, Mark Zuckerberg's favorite, making us all, welfare recipients. So that's not new. What's new is that you used to be able to shut down the debate by saying, yeah, interesting, but we can't afford it. And they're going, yeah, you're right. We can't pay for that. Yeah, too bad. That's gone. The MMT takes that away. It says, yes, we can. The answer is yes, we can afford it. Yes, we can pay for it because we are unconstrained by budget, bond market, taxes, PEGA, all those things that are kind of out there don't apply anymore. Just spend and then kind of figure it out after the fact. So here, as I said, here we go. So what I see coming from the Biden administration is kind of one foreign policy economic catastrophe after another. I'm fairly relaxed about it. I can see it coming, but I don't own it. The problem with voting for Trump is that it was just exhausting to be any kind of Trump supporter because he picked fights with his friends. I mean, you couldn't be his friend. And if you mention Trump at a cocktail party, you get a drink thrown in your face or someone storm away from the dinner table. It was just, I just like Trump's policy, the Abraham Accords, getting out of Paris Accord, getting out of joint memorandum on joint comprehensive plan of action on Iran, et cetera. I liked a lot of his policies, but you couldn't say that without just getting trashed. So it was just really hard work to like those policies. But now I don't own it. I obviously watch it closely. I write about it. I talk about it, but it's on them. It's on Biden and you can see what we're going to get.
How about the other side? I mean, the however you want to characterize it, the divide in the Republican Party and the immediate to longer-term future within the picture that you're talking about.
The Republican Party does have a major divide. You're exactly right. They're going to have to resolve it in the next 2 years. I mean, the love this Fox News decision desk. They said on election night that the Democrats were going to pick up 10 seats. Well, actually, they lost 10 seats. So Nancy Pelosi's working majority, there are a couple of vacancies, and there's always a little wiggle room around the margins, but her working majority is about 10 seats, kind of 222 to 213, give or take, which means she can only lose 5 or 6 votes at most before the Republicans carry the day. That's not a comfortable cushion. And the Republicans are positioned to take over the House and the Senate in 2022. We'll see what happens. But in the meantime, they got to resolve their own differences. So you got these 10 Republicans who voted for impeachment, including Liz Cheney. But the Freedom Caucus is out. They may try to strip Liz Cheney of her number three position in the Republican leadership. These people may get primaried by more conservative or populist, opponents, in the 2022 cycle. So we'll see how it plays out. That's a little hard to predict. But the Democrats have an internal war between the extreme progressives and the more moderates. The Republicans have an internal war between your so-called country club Republicans and the populists, the Trump wing. They both have to sort it out. I remember during the Cold War, I studied Russia and nuclear war fighting scenarios and all that. We actually did that. But the generals and say, well, the Russians are getting too strong, they're building too many missiles and all that. And then you could shut them up by saying, well, who would you rather be, us or them? And they would kind of say, well, I'd rather be us. So the Republicans have struggled, the Democrats have struggled. You'd rather be with the Republican side because you can see a strong comeback in the coming years. But, it's political dysfunction on steroids and get rid of it. But, for now, the Democrats are in charge. They have their working majorities in both houses of Congress and the White House, and they'll start to control judicial appointments and get rid of the filibuster, and so they're gonna rule the day. But the important thing I think for investors is to understand what their policies are. Major tax increases coming. They want to take the individual rate back where it was under Obama, but they want to move the corporate rate in the same direction. They want to get rid of the capital gains rate and make that the ordinary rate, which is will be 39.6%. And the other way they raise taxes is eliminating deductions. You have to understand the difference between statutory tax rates and effective tax rates. The effective tax rate is what you actually pay after all your deductions. The statutory tax rate is the one you can look up in a book. Well, the effective tax rate is typically lower. Well, it's always lower because you have deductions and credits and so forth. But you can keep the statutory tax rate the same and eliminate the deductions. And what happens is the effective rate goes up. That's the one that we actually write the check and people pay. So you're going to see effective rates go up by the elimination of deductions, even if the statutory rate doesn't go up, which it will. And so that's going to, that on top of what we talked about earlier with the pandemic. So the lockdowns, but the pandemic's back, never went away, but it's back, not going away soon. I wouldn't count on the vaccines. And we're locking down half the economy. And here comes a new administration that is going to raise taxes across the board, eliminate deductions, raise effective rates. This is just going to body slam the U.S. economy. By the way, one quick footnote, Keith. One of the most virulent, or if that's the right word, harsh criticisms of Obama, he, from 2008 to 2010, he had a working majority in the House and Senate. Mm-hmm. And they did two big things. They did Obamacare, of course, and Dodd-Frank. And they got it done. But from 2010 to 2016, he had no major legislative accomplishments, none. He was, you know, he was president and did stuff, but they didn't get anything done because the Republicans took back the House in 2010 and controlled the Senate. So they said, why didn't you do more when you had the chance, you know, on immigration and, you know, some of these others? You had the 2-year window. Why didn't you do more? So now they're looking back on that, looking at Biden and saying, okay, you may lose the House in 2022. That's entirely possible. You better do everything you can in the next 2 years. So they're going to front load the progressive agenda for fear that they lose the working majority in 2 years. So, you know, watch out. This is going to be 100 days like we've never seen.
Well, I'm shocked that I haven't, in 40 minutes, I haven't used the word quad one time in this conversation. but what you just said is really interesting within my framework, because basically the best of times, cyclical times, growth and inflation, quad two quite literally ends in Q2 of this year. So you have this front-end loaded everything. And if the next, right. and then I have quad four hitting. Now, every politician since the beginning of politicians gets body bagged by quad four. Doesn't matter what party they're in, there are only two parties, whammo. So that's going to be, if we're right, and again, it comes from a high point, or in the case of interest rates, comes from a cyclically high point and then straight back down. Then you have that, I didn't think of it, I mean, as often is the case, I mean, I talk to somebody who's thinking about it longer term, and then I go to my quad box, I'm like, yeah, the damn thing's going to, that those elections are going to be staring you right in the face. So that's interesting. One more question on this before we take questions, and obviously the first question is going to be about gold, so we'll just let the audience ask that. but some of the things that you write are just awesome, man. But like the silencing of the conservative voices, this is something that was quite interesting to me, just given, you know, both of us with presences on Twitter and you know, having that voice. Like, what is it? And I'm not saying that we have to be conservative or liberal or whatever. I like to say I go both ways anyway. But the fact of the matter is that you wrote that, and I wonder what you thought the tale was on that.
Well, you know, I recently, I lost, like in the past week, I lost 10,000 followers on Twitter. I was about 179,000. I went down to 169,000. Thank you, Jack. It reminds me of that scene in The Godfather where they're in the kitchen, Fat Clemenza's there, and somebody says, anybody seen Paulie? And he goes, oh, Paulie, you won't see him no more. I mean, because he got whacked. When I saw the drop, I said, you know, I sent out a tweet. I said, was it something I said, you know, question mark. But I know what happened. It's not like, you know, 10,000 people like got up and left. They got whacked by Twitter. Their accounts were disabled. There's a whole scenario behind that. You know, life goes on. Like I never, my day wasn't like better or worse because of Twitter followers, but it was just interesting to watch.
Yeah.
So they must have whacked, you know, and Byron York lost 40,000, Victoria Tenzing lost 100,000. But nobody targeted me. It wasn't like, oh, we're going to mess up Jim's Twitter account. What they did is they whacked probably millions of accounts, of which, you know, 10,000 happened to follow me and they disappeared, you know, whatever. This is a purge. It looks like what Stalin did in the 1930s, you know, Bukharin and Zinoviev and all these guys. You know, Trotsky got killed in Mexico with an ice axe. That's a hard way to go, but it was no hotel room in Mexico. I'm a mountain climber, so I know what an ice axe can do on ice, but you know, different when you get killed that way. But so this was a purge. They're completely, once it was clear that Biden's going to get sworn in and they had Congress, all the constraints were off. You no longer had to even pretend that you weren't doing it. And it's across the board. I mean, They're sending out lists. This looks like McCarthyism, you know, the Hollywood 10 from the 1950s, et cetera. So they're saying to universities, you know, if you hire anyone, give any kind of faculty position whatsoever, anyone who ever worked in the Trump administration, you know, we're going to boycott you. And they're saying to corporations, if you donate to Republicans, we're going to boycott you. They want to put Ted Cruz on a no-fly list. I know Ted Cruz. I spent time with him. He was, you know, like number one in his class at Harvard Law School. He was the Solicitor General of Texas. I mean, a Solicitor General is not a trial lawyer. A Solicitor General is an appellate lawyer. They're considered the big brains of the legal profession. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who argue pure legal matters in front of the Supreme Court. And he was a clerk to, I think, Rehnquist. I may be wrong about that, but certainly one of the most prominent Supreme Court justices. So Ted Cruz is actually one of the smartest people you ever met, and, you know, and a nice guy. So he should be on the no-fly list, according to, you know, all this cancel culture stuff. So it's bad. It's going to get worse. You know, and, you know, Parler got whacked. So what you say is, well, where are the antitrust laws? This looks like, you know, the Rockefeller Trust and the Morgan Trust around 1900, you know, just vertically integrated, immensely powerful, buying off politicians and destroying competition. That's what happened, you know, 120 years ago, and it's happening now, except 120 years ago, they enacted the antitrust laws and they broke it up. And these companies were broken up by around 1912. So where's the antitrust enforcement? Well, it's not going to happen. I mean, yeah, the laws are on the books. They apply the same way. But if the Justice Department chooses not to enforce it, then nothing happens. So where, you know, big tech, big media, and the Democratic Party, cancel culture, progressive, where they all like hold hands and decide they're just going to crush conservative voices and Republican voices, you know, et cetera, populist voices. You got to deal with it. You know, come up with alternative platforms. You know, I probably shouldn't say this in public, but one of the few, you know, because I'm on Twitter, I'm active on social media, and I do podcasts and I do, you know, TV and all kinds of stuff. One of the few media that have not been crushed, where I would say I look at, are books, actually. And I look at, and I applaud that, you know, publishers and editors. They got to stand up. And so, you know, my book is out. Although, you know, Josh Hawley, Simon Schuster canceled his book contract. Book's coming out in 3 months. I know from writing books that 3 months is not a long lead time. You cannot, you know, copy, edit, print, box, distribute, et cetera, a book in less than 3 or 4 months from when it's done.
Yeah.
Which means that his book is done. It's baked and it's just in the process of getting out there. And Simon Schuster whacked it. So even books wow. aren't safe. Maybe we'll get to book burning sooner than later. But yeah, it's pretty bad, but we'll power through it.
Yeah, that's it's pretty bad. It's pathetic, really, is what it is. Okay, first question. Like I said, it's going to be about gold, of course. Bottom line, this is John in Arkansas. Bottom line, Jim, you say you should be buying gold now. Keith, your process says don't buy gold now. Can you come to a consensus that the investor can understand? Now, I'll hit that first because I'm the one who's going to stir that nest a little bit. You know, to be clear, you know, I sold gold and I am short, sold GLD, paper gold, you know, own my physical gold, never sold that, never will, right. And shorted GLD over the course of the one quad, when you get a rate of change breakout in interest rates, cyclical one, you know, I shorted gold, and I'm most likely, if I'm right, you know, I'm wrong a lot too, if it's going to be like a six-month thing. And then I'm going to buy the living shit out of gold. So if you want to it's not to getting a consensus. That's what I'm doing, and that's what I've always done, and I don't apologize for it, but that's, I think when people, I think part of this, Jim, part of the question too, is that people really have belief systems, and it's really hard to overlay a risk management system like mine that's data-driven with a belief system because they need to or want to believe just one thing. Do you think that's fair?
First of all, I think it's fair. Secondly, I agree with what you described, Keith, in terms of a horizon. Now, I'm not a trader. I'm an investor. I don't have I don't do paper gold. And look, if you just want price exposure and you want to get in or out and you're a hedge fund, I get calls from hedge funds. I can't mention names, but let's just say that if I did mention the name, you go, oh yeah, that guy got it. So they talk to me, and but they do trade paper gold by and large, and it's a position you can get in and out leveraged. I get it. And that's fine. I mean, that's what a lot of people do. A lot of what your clients do. But I'm in physical gold. The bid offer spreads are actually large when you count commission, but commission is really physical gold scarce, by the way. You go out and buy some physical gold, you'll be surprised how much higher it is compared to paper gold.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, they're ripping me off in commission. Well, not really. It is commission, but that's actually the bid offer. It's kind of all in pricing is one way to think about it. But here's the thing. I don't consider myself a technician, but I do look at charts, and to me, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think technical analysis has low predictive value, all things equal, but if enough people believe it, it becomes true whether it makes sense or not. So I do look at charts. And so the drivers of gold are, first of all, fair trade, geopolitical factors, that's one. But good old supply and demand still counts, that's two. And the third one is interest rates. Well, the first two are supporting gold. And geopolitical, we're not in any wars or hot spots, but it's just kind of there, certainly with regard to Iran and some other places. And the supply-demand is all in favor of supporting gold prices, because supply has been flat for like 5 years, about 3,200 metric tons per year, but it's not going up. I'm invested in some gold mines, and I can tell you from, I've been 700 feet underground, it's hard to find. But the thing that's crushing gold are interest rates. So what's going on with interest rates? By the way, I spent a long time trashing the efficient market hypothesis, and I keep doing it, and I will keep doing it because it's junk science, but they teach it. I mean, they teach people this junk, and so you got to deal with it. So here's the notion. The notion is markets look, 6 months forward. They see what's coming. They apply a discount factor. They discount it back to the present value, and markets efficiently and smoothly incorporate all the information and reflect where things are going to be in 6 months. And you can't beat the market, so don't even try. That's efficient market hypothesis in a nutshell. Markets do look forward, and they always get it wrong. They always get it wrong. They did not see the dot-com crash coming. They did not see the 2008 financial crisis coming. They did not see the pandemic. I did, talked about it in my last book. They did not see the 2020 crash. Markets always get it wrong. Now, that doesn't mean fight the market, because that's a good way to lose money, but don't stop thinking of markets as they discount the wrong future. That's probably the best way to describe it. So what are markets saying right now? Well, they're saying, here come the $2,000 checks, and that's correct. So there's going to be another $2 trillion of deficit spending in the next few months. People are going to get $2,000 checks, and they're going to take those checks and run right out and buy a new car, refrigerator, carpet the house, whatever. This is going to drive consumption. This is going to drive the economy higher. It's probably a little bit inflationary, and interest rates have to go up. And they are going up. 10-year note yield to maturity has gone from like 90 basis points to, I think it's about 110, 115 basis points today. So, and that's bad for gold, because gold has no yield. Oh, gee, 10-year notes are going up in yield. So give me the 10-year notes, because I'll take the higher yield. Got it. There's one problem with that, which is that interest rates, they might go up a little higher. I wouldn't rule that out. And then they're going to get slammed. They're going to go straight down. This has happened. Just look at a 10-year chart of yield maturity on 10-year notes. This happened like four times. Mm-hmm. And by the way, every peak is lower than the one before. Yeah. It used to be, got to 2.5, crushed, got to 2.25, crushed. Now, I don't know, 1.5, whatever, pick a number. It's going to get crushed again. Why? Go back to what we said earlier. You're locking right now, today, you're locking down half the economy. Pandemic is worse than ever. The vaccine distribution has been bungled. The White House, Trump picked a 3-star general to run the logistics. This guy's a genius. They got the doses. The pharmaceutical companies created the vaccine. They got the dosage made, produced. They paid for everything. They shipped it. Everyone's Christmas cards were late. Everyone's like, why are my Christmas cards late? This guy took over the Postal Service to get the vaccine out there. So they got to the point of delivery, but that's where it broke down. So it's to the point, this stuff's got to be 100 below zero to preserve. So when you get it, you defrost it, bring it to room temperature. It's like a quart of milk. If you don't use it in 2 days, it goes bad. And that's what's happening. New York is actually throwing away the vaccine because it's gone bad, because they couldn't get it injected fast enough. Why? Because, obviously, who should you inject? Well, over 65 with comorbidities, asthma, diabetes, et cetera, and frontline healthcare workers. Give it to them first. That's easy. Not what they did. Like, well, maybe this neighborhood got disadvantaged 40 years ago, so maybe we ought to give them a little vaccine. Fine. That's a real good way to waste your dosages and not get it done. Leaving aside the fact that this English strain, so-called, or South African strain, it's more contagious. It's a mutation. It's more contagious. We don't, and that means fatalities go up. Everyone's, like, the fatality rate is not going up. Screw the rate. The number of deaths is going up. The absolute number of fatalities goes up along with the caseload, whether the percentage rate changes or not. Who cares? People are dying. And is there something called mutation escape? I had to kind of become an epidemiologist, virologist to write my book. Mutation escape is when the virus mutates around the antibodies. So here's the virus, the antibodies, where the mutate goes, oh, here we go. I'm in the backfield because I'm a new kind of virus. That happens. It's happened frequently. Some viruses, some mutations are harmless. Some are do exactly what I just described. So for all those reasons, best case, the vaccine's not going to have an impact until late 2021. Worst case, we're back in this thing worse than ever. So, okay, take everything I just said. That's going to slam the economy. One other thing's going to slam the economy, higher interest rates. So the interest rate's going to, so right now, interest rates are going up. Gold price is going down. It finds support around 1775 for the fundamental reasons I mentioned. It finds resistance at around 1950, you know, $1,950 per ounce, because interest rates are going up. It's been kind of trading in range in the 1800s or whatever. And that's where it sits. What is it going to take for gold prices to break out of the high end of the range, go past $2,000 and keep going? Well, it's going to take a sharp decline in interest rates. Mm-hmm. But since the market's inefficient, not efficient, you're going to have to see the data. It's starting to show up, by the way. Initial claims today were surprisingly high. Job creation went down. We lost jobs in December. Those are early warning signs of what I just described, which is a second recession in the first quarter of 2021. It'll take Wall Street, you know, another 3 or 4 months, kind of what time horizon you were describing, to wake up to the reality. But when they do, interest rates are going to come down. The stock market's going to come down and gold's going to go up. But that's probably 3 to 6 months away. So I don't disagree with your forecast and your trading strategy, even though I take a more long-term view of it.
Yeah. It's to each their own strategy. I think like you said before, you like to read books about things that you don't agree with, or you like everyone has a different investment time horizon. They have a different characterization of holdings or asset allocations, however they've thought about it. And it's just like, get over yourself. Just do what you do and try to understand what other people do and empathize with that. And you might actually come up with some good ideas on how to do what you do better. Right. Last question, just because we only have time for one more here, Jim. And I know that this is going to be, because you were one of the first people to ever write about this. So is Avery from California asking what your thoughts are on the dollar's status as a reserve world reserve currency, and will it stay that way, or do you think that this is like basically the beginning of the end?
Yeah, great question. My wife hates me to admit this, but I was a registered lobbyist in Washington at one time, and I ran an office down there. I spent a lot of time up on Capitol Hill and learned a lot. One of the first things I learned in Washington is you can't beat something with nothing. So if there's a policy or program, you hate it, you write op-eds, you scream against it, whatever. Nobody cares unless you have an alternative. If you want to change this, come up with this, because you can't beat something with nothing. So people who doubt the dollar, question the dollar, oh, it's going to lose its status as reserve currency. Okay, maybe. But my first question is, what's going to replace it? Because something has to replace it. And so let's look at the contenders. First of all, people don't understand what reserve currencies are. You know, so 60% of global reserves are in dollars, about 25%, give or take, are in euros. So 85% of reserve currencies are in two currencies, the dollar and the euro. And all of your dollar indices, I don't care if it's Dixie, Bloomberg, Fed, whatever, they're basically euro US dollar cross rates. That's what they are. I mean, yeah, you can throw in the yen and sterling and all that, but it doesn't change that much. It's the euro US dollar cross rate, because they're 85% of global reserves. But reserves aren't held in currencies. It's not like the People's Bank of China has a big has pallets of $100 bills stacked up in the basement of their headquarters. You have to invest in securities. They buy treasury notes, treasury bills. They have 1.4 trillion in treasury notes. They don't have pallets of $100 bills. The point being, when you say reserve currency, what you're really talking about are reserve assets denominated in a currency. So if you're looking for the alternative, show me the bond market. All these Bitcoin groupies saying, Bitcoin's going to replace. Where's the Bitcoin bond market? By the way, it doesn't exist. Where's the Chinese yuan bond market? Doesn't exist. Won't exist for 20 years at best. That's if there's regime change. I mean, to have a bond market, I mean, just I'll be brief. That's the thing. You need bonds in all maturities. You need liquidity. You need primary dealers, auctions, settlement and payments, repo, forwards, when issued, futures, hedging. I mean, rule of law. Why don't we start there? You need all that stuff to support a bond market. That's why the treasury market is what it is. And even if you want, and there is no euro bond. I don't mean dollar denominated bonds issued in London. I mean a bond denominated in euro backed by the full faith and credit of the European monetary system. Doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So if you want euro exposure in the bond market, you got to buy bunds or, you know, Italian. Good luck with that. But so there really is no alternative to the dollar because there's no bond market. There's no rule of law and there won't be anytime soon. Now, when people say the dollar is going up or dollar is going down, they don't really understand that either, because as I mentioned, the Dixie or the Bloomberg dollar index, it's just a euro US dollar cross rate. So what it really means is the dollar is going down against the euro. Okay, how far can that go? Because when the euro gets strong enough, the European economy is going to be in the sink. So, because they're importing our deflation. So currencies are not like stocks. They don't go to major reserve currency. They don't go to zero like Hertz, and they don't go to the moon like Apple. They trade in a range. Yeah. 21 years, the euro, the low was 80 cents and the high was $1.60. But I was in Europe when it was 80 cents. It was great. You couldn't spend $100 dinner for seven with the works. But those two were extremes. Most of the trading is between $1 and $1.40 and an even narrower range, about $1.05 to $1.25. So it goes to the top and then it goes down, it goes to the top and then it goes down. So currency trading, just understand what I just said, pick the pivot points and that's how you trade currencies. But it doesn't mean anything because of the dynamic I just described. If you want to understand how the dollar is doing, look at the dollar price of gold, because gold is not, it is a form of money, but it's not a form of currency, but it's the only form of money not controlled by a central bank. All the fiat currencies, they're in the same lifeboat. Some are taller and shorter, you know, better looking or not so, whatever, but they're all in the same lifeboat. They're going to sink or swim together. But gold isn't. And so if you said to me, what's the dollar doing right now? Well, right now it's getting stronger because the dollar price of gold is going down. I expect that to reverse by the summer, and the dollar will get weaker and the dollar price of gold will go up. But the gold is like, you know, putting a thermometer in a patient's mouth. I guess now we use scanners or whatever. It's like taking the patient's temperature. If you want to know how the dollar's doing, look at the dollar price of gold, mm-hmm. and that will tell you.
Well, that I think you must have been the first person to teach me that. That, you know, you're the first person to just explicitly state with no apologies that that gold is a currency. That is, I think you were. Can I give you that? At least in my own mind, which is at least the only thing that really matters to me. I mean, it's like
at least in the last 50 years. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's once I wrapped my head around that, I was able to do, like, again, just lending, you know, to the prior statement that I made. I mean, we all stand on the shoulders of giants. I'm not saying that you're, you know, the second coming of Christ, and I'm certainly not either. But I mean, it's like you took all this history and you made your conclusions. I think it was called The New Bull Case for Gold. The book is
the new case for gold. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that really, you know, that really changed some components of my process, because once I looked at gold as a currency instead of a commodity, which I had prior, still, when you look in Bloomberg lookups, you know, talk about data, old wall, everything else, you're going to always find gold in the commodity baskets. You're going to find it in the commodity departments. You're not going to find it as a currency or the currency in dollars, which you just you know, eloquently stated. So that to me is a real important point. I mean, that's and most importantly, you know, if you study economic history in rate of change terms, and you have a 2x2 model, what's growth and inflation doing, like my quad model, you're going to find that really the only time the dollar goes up a lot is in quad 4 anyway. So when you think about And that's because there's deflation. So people are like, holy shit, I got to sell all this stuff that I own.
Right.
and that's, yeah, I got to thank you again for that, because that's really, I would call that a cornerstone of my process, right? If you don't have cornerstones and rules in your process, what the hell do you have? I mean, you just,
right.
You know, so I think some people wake up in the morning, particularly now with, and I'm long Bitcoin, you know, it's not my entire net worth, you know, I'm long it and it's fun and all that stuff, but so is being long corn. Like, I really don't look at a difference between the two, or my wine cellar for that matter, and these maxis laugh at me and it's whatever, but I'm kind of laughing about it with my wife. I mean, it's all working out pretty well. I mean, if you can just reduce, you know, asset allocation to that, I think you'll do better than some people, quite literally, Jim, wake up in the morning saying, the world's reserve currency is going to be replaced by Bitcoin. I'm going to hodl that until I die.
Well, hodl on, but it won't be reserve currency. But the reason is not that, the reason is because there's no bond market. You need something to invest in to be a reserve currency. I'll give you a 30-second masterclass.
Or short it. You can't even short Bitcoin.
Correct. Right? It has none of the attributes of the securities market around which a reserve currency is founded. It just doesn't. But I'll give you a 30-second masterclass on gold. Of course it does well in inflation. Everybody kind of understands that. Gold does extremely well in deflation. The greatest period of sustained deflation in US history was the Great Depression. Gold went up 75% in dollar terms, from $20 to $35 in the deflation. I explain this in chapter 6 in the conclusion of my book. If people are interested, you can turn to the end and go to the last episode of the season. But if you look at the end, hopefully, you know, read the whole thing. But if you get, you read the conclusion, you'll see why gold is the only way out of the new Great Depression.
I mean, and again, gold just did exactly that when we were long it for the last 2 years. It was at 2100 when the dollar and interest rates were going down at the same time, and the world was pricing in the deepest deflation we've seen. So that is 100% correct. And thank you again to you, Jim Rickards, for teaching me that. I'd encourage all of you, like, literally read them in order, every one of his books. And at a bare minimum, it's going to trigger you like you wouldn't believe, because you probably didn't know a lot of these things. And it's okay to be triggered. That's what we want. We want to, and I think of Hedgeye TV and our conversations as, at least it's part of my education. So thanks for, you know, helping educate other people on your views and explaining them in full. I know they appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Keith. Thanks for inviting me.
And congrats on your new book. That's Jim Rickards. He's the one and only. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient, provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.